second part. I'm going to talk mostly about RIA services, those of RIA services, which is a feature of Silverlight 4. But before that, my name is Nikhil Kothari. I'm an architect at Microsoft. I worked on ASP.NET for many, many years, and I worked on Silverlight for almost the last 4 years. And RIA services, in some sense, brings the two together. I also have Jeff, who's on the Silverlight team, also works on Silverlight as well as Windows Phone, who probably might show some demos, and you can talk about Silverlight and Phone. In terms of the format for this, I want to show, I have very few slides. I'll show a demo, and hopefully have Q&A in general, like if you have questions. So to kind of get a sense, how many people have used or heard of RIA services? Okay, so most people, that's good. How many people actually have used it and have questions or dying to ask? No hands. So it's a perfect technology. It does everything. It's so simple, there's no questions. I love that. So we had a certain goal. We had a certain vision for the technology. A lot of it was, I like to think of it as, I spent 8 years in ASP.NET and a couple of years in Silverlight, and we have .NET on both sides, server and client. There's all sorts of interesting things to go do by bringing them together, and more specifically, bringing them together to simplify developing these sort of end-tier data-driven applications, and do it by bringing together a lot of the technologies we have. Things like Link, multiple data access technologies, WCF, the notion of metadata that spans client and server. Those are some of the key building blocks. Like the metadata one was some very early thoughts around, I have metadata in my schema, whether it's a SQL database or some other data store. Why isn't that intent transferred all the way to the client without you having to specify that at every level? So that was an interesting part of the problem space and the vision. And then we wanted to provide sort of an application architecture that scaled to the very sort of simple applications that are sort of, you can almost think of those as the drag drop, get this thing working, because the goal is to get a scenario working for a short time as opposed to a much more complex application that you might want to spend more time with architecture to have a model that scales to both ends. So that's sort of what went into the idea. Let me actually show a very quick demo. This is sort of the, start from scratch and try to get something working in 5 minutes, we'll see. Should have started Visual Studio while I was waiting there. All right, we'll start with a new application. I don't usually use this mouse on my laptop. Silverlight business application, we'll create one of these applications. It creates a client application, a Silverlight application, as well as a server application, the ASP.NET server application. And the two are hooked up together. They're part of a single larger application that spans both tiers. I'll go to my server application and add a data model that I want to use for my application. I'll call this book club. Just go next. I'll pick a table. Books table. So now I have a data model. I'll just build. Okay. Now I will go add something called a domain service. Domain service. I'll call this the book club service. And this gives me an option to go ahead and pick that book club data model that I just created and choose the book entity. And I want all the editing features turned on for this. And it creates a domain service which has which builds on top of that data model, book club entities. And it has four methods: get books, insert book, update book, delete book. Basically the four CRUD operations. And so now let me go ahead and build. And let me go to my client side. On the client in the Silverlight UI, let me open up this home page. Open up the data source window. And because these two are part of the same application, as soon as I open up the data sources window, it recognizes the fact that I have these books being exposed by the server half of the application to the client half of the application. I will go ahead and drag and drop this thing. And it knows that there's a query method called getBooks that returns all the books. And the book has these fields. It all just clicks together. I'm going to completely ignore how ugly the UI is going to look and just keep dragging and dropping. Here's the details view, bound to the same thing. And at this point, I'll just run. So it'll go ahead and load some data. The data is loaded from the back end. Again, ignore the UI. And as I page through or select different rows in the grid, the detailed form updates, I can actually choose to edit something. And the basic validation already happening. The author field is required. I didn't specify that anywhere, but it happened to come through because in my schema, that was declared as a, in my database schema, that was declared as a non-nullable, with a non-nullable constraint. And so that flowed all the way through to the client. I haven't done any submit anything. The client is just showing me that error. So that's a quick run through to kind of get a very quick sense of Rea services in action. Now, let me show a different application now, one that you can't really build with this drag and drop. But the idea is this drag and drop thing is useful for the kinds of applications. So how many people use SharePoint, for example? SharePoint has this feature where you can define a list. And you can say, here's all these columns. And I want the list view. And I want this list to be editable. I want users to be able to add new items. There's very little specific application logic on the client needed for that kind of application. It's basically the standard CRUD application. So if your application is like that and you need something where up and running quickly, then you don't actually have to write much code other than the code on the server. All the stuff kind of just hangs together. Of course, you can tweak the UI to make it look better than what I have here in 5 minutes. But the idea is there's very little actual application logic. But in a lot of applications, there is significant amount of application logic on the client. There's also a significant amount of application logic on the server beyond just these four methods with one-liner implementations in them. So I want to give you an example of this, and this is actually the book club application that I've published on CodePlex under the Rea Services project. How many people have seen that, downloaded it? I don't see any hands up. So I certainly recommend, reaservices.codeplex.com. It's sort of a reference application. Let me actually just run it. So let's search for, okay, it came up. It has the notion of a book of a day, and books related to that are similar to that, based on going out to Amazon and looking at, similar books. Looking at what books are in the book club and presenting that. I can search for books, so let's say I search for Silverlight. It comes up there. I can, select different books. I can log in. So let me go ahead and log in. services, notion of authentication and a user context that spans client and server. Once I'm logged in, I can go look at my bookshelf, look at books that I might have shared out, you know, that kind of thing. I can go ahead and edit books. Same type of thing. I get the same kind of errors. You notice it showed you things that are pending edits. I can actually make multiple edits, hit submit once. So it's a fairly extensive application that kind of shows you a number of advanced concepts in RIA services. It's about validation. It shows you entity level validation, field level validation, operation level validation, as well as change set level validation. I submit a whole set of changes back to the server. It shows how I might actually, my database has multiple tables. I don't want to present all of those tables to the client. I want to create a sort of a presentation model on the server that's particularly geared for the client. And so how I can take data on the server, massage it, and reshape it, and send that to the client. It has authentication. It has a number of features. So rather than kind of go through a ton of code, what I thought is to kind of just use this as a basis to see if any questions come up based on what you've seen, the little you've seen, or, you know, based on your experience. Any, who wants to go first? There you go. Let me try to. So the question was around caching different queries. So multiple calls to the server. You made multiple calls to the server, and you wanted to get different results.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let me use this as an example of if there's a question that I can try and, you know, show the answer to in the context of this book club application, that would be an interesting way to do it, probably. So let me try to address your question by saying. There's a number of, so if I look at this implementation of this book club service, it has a method called getLatestBooks. And let's say I want to refresh that, so the client always gets a different different set of books every time. What I can actually indicate here is an output cache, and I can specify where to cache. Cache in the server, cache in the client, don't cache, for how long. All of those options are actually available to you. So in this particular application, I might actually say, you know, get latest books doesn't change that often, so I want to actually cache for a day. So this is kind of an example of a hint that you can provide to the on-this query method that lets RIA services customize the protocol between the client and the server while you focus on the implementation of the query method. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Anyone wants to see validation? That's my favorite thing, and because it actually shows how we did all the work to think of your application, the two aspects of your application, as a single application and solve some scenarios end to end. Is that interesting? All right. So let me show validation in the context of. Don't want to save. So let me actually run this application again. So when I click, when I make a change here, this is sort of what's called sort of field level validation. And the way field level validation works is on the server, when I created this data model, I got a class like book, and what I can do is add additional. So the non-nullability constraint comes from the database, so I don't need to add it myself. But I can go ahead and add other rules. For example, here's the ASIN, which is the Amazon ID for a book, and I have attached a rule saying it needs to match this particular regular expression. So this is a field level rule that I'm specifying. That's one validation attribute. And if you look at the book class on the client that we automatically generate for you, if I say show generated code. So let me show you the book class on the client. So here's the ASIN property on the generated book class on the client. It has that regular expression. So we took your intent from the server and transferred it to the client. It's required because that's the way it was specified in the database. The database also has some constraints on it. It is at most 10 characters long, so that's that string length. So what we've done is moved the field validation over. So now let me show entity level validation. I specified over here an entity level validation that basically entity level validation is when your rule depends on multiple fields, so you can't validate just a single field. So I created a method called added date follows the published date. So when the book was added to the book club, it must be after the published date of the book. So let's look at this method. So I have a class called book rules, and it has a method called added date follows published date. Now I put this code in a file called bookrules.shared.cs, and that's a naming convention. Anytime you have a shared file, it gets copied over to the client as well. So if I look at my client code, you'll notice that here this file shows up there as well. And on the class itself, on the generated class itself, you'll notice that custom validation as well. So we have entity level validation. So now let's say I want to this is sort of validation that's specific to the data model. Now there's also operations in my app. For example, I want to be able to share a book and add it into the book club. But when adding it to the book club, I want to perform operation level validation. So when I go to the bookshelf service, so again, this is a class that's similar to that other domain service that was created, except it has a lot more code in it. For example, here's share book. Now inside here, I have these methods like book exists. If the book already exists in the book club, then here's a validation exception. If the book has an invalid ASIN, that's a validation exception as well. So these are validations that are specific not to the book type, but to the share book operation. So we have operation null validation. And what happens is when you raise this validation exception, the exception flows all the way back to the client. The client gets the validation error, and it can display that in the UI. So we have basically a model for validation that's across all of these different levels. Any question on what you saw in the validation? Question there.
What about the localization and the validation?
Okay. So the question is on localization. So let me go to my class here, book. So regular expression has an error message property. Now, what we also have is a error message resource name. Actually, you can see it right here. So we have error message resource name and error message resource type. So you can actually specify the resource type, which is based on your resx class, a resx file, and the resource key. And if you make that resx be marked as shared.resx, it will also get copied over to the client. And this way, you'll get localized error messages.
Okay.
So this is a common pattern that we have for a number of our attributes that are meant to be shared across server and client. Any other questions? Do people have general questions on Silverlight? Or there's a question there? There is no compile time checking because it's just a string. However, what we do, I believe, is when we generate code into the client, we will check that the method actually exists. So when you compile the client code is when you'll see the error rather than compiling the server code. Question up there.
Can you tell something about the underlying service?
Okay. Let me actually go back to, I have a slide that kind of puts this in context. So, is that what the Lucf Rio services is built on the Lucf. What's happening is the class that you write is sort of the programming model layer. You're thinking about, here's the operations, here's the business logic I have to go write, not about the actual endpoint. The actual endpoint is what we actually generate for you behind the scenes. And in the case of the Silverlight application back to the server, we create an efficient endpoint that does binary serialization. But I can also create additional endpoints and use more of the underlying WCF infrastructure. So I'll just kind of show a very quick... So going back to the quick demo that I ran. Let me go ahead and create another domain service. Called domain service one. So you'll notice here, out of the box, we have this option called expose OData endpoint. I can check that, and you can also write your own endpoints as well, just that our UI has that. And so what now happens is I have this class called domain service one. It doesn't specify how it should be exposed. That's what the endpoints do. If I look in config, you'll notice in the system.service model config section, which is the WCF config section, we have created this section called endpoints, and we've added one for OData. And this basically says apply the OData endpoint to the services. And so now I can go ahead and use the OData protocol to access the same business logic. Was there a more specific question? Okay.
Unit testing, are you supposed to use tests on this or are you not?
Question on unit testing. You can unit test these methods. So a domain service is basically a class that has these current methods. You can, in your unit test, you can just new this class up and call the methods. Now, what I've been doing in this demo here is using this data model that was generated by using entity framework. I could instead use a repository as my source of data within my domain service. And that actually allows you to then go mock your storage as well. But these classes are certainly meant to be unit tested. In fact, I have a slide that kind of speaks to that a little bit. One of the key principles that we have is that your application logic is sort of a core asset. And it needs to kind of scale, both in terms of being able to talk to different kinds of databases or different kinds of data stores, including NoSQL type data stores, and it needs to be able to be consumed by multiple kinds of front-end technologies, whether it's Silverlight or Ajax or even server-side ASP.NET like MVC or WebForms. But just like any other presentation client, you have unit test code that can also directly instantiate your application logic layer and test it. And that is very much the idea of why we separated this out into a layer by its own and made it concrete. So if there's general interest in more Windows Phone related stuff, we can have Jeff over here as well, or there's more questions, I'm happy to try and answer this question here. So let me try to understand. I think you're saying you've got your business logic is as a, implemented as a service, right?
Just as normal example is.
Well, in some sense, that is this application logic, which you can think of a domain service as basically the front end layer that's exposed to clients. What it does internally is can be as simple as calling to a database directly, or calling into a business logic layer that you already have existing, or calling into another service that implements the business logic. Really, the clients don't care how you implement your query method or your other query methods as well. So let me try and find a suitable example for that over here. Let me contrast these two methods. So I have multiple query methods in this service. I have a method called getLatestBooks, which basically goes uses the Entity Framework object context directly, right? And returns a list of those books. As far as the client goes, all it knows is that there's a query method called getLatestBooks. It doesn't actually know the implementation of that method. So let's look at this other method that I have called getBookOfTheDay. In this particular case, I'm still using Entity Framework, but I'm actually going and calling a stored procedure. Again, the client doesn't know I'm calling a stored procedure. I could very well have been calling into another library that is my business logic layer. In fact, in this particular method, getBookOfTheDay, what it does is it calls into a stored procedure to find a book, and then it goes to Amazon to find similar products. So it's going to a different web service altogether to get back additional data, and it's intersecting those two things, data in the local database with data coming back from Amazon, combining them and returning that to the client. So at the end of the day, there's a pattern for query methods, which is any method that returns an enumerable or an iterable. The implementation of that can do anything. Similarly, there's a pattern for this example doesn't have it, but in the other domain service within this class, I have shareBook, which is basically an insert method. Update book, which is an update method, and unshare book, which is a delete method. So as far as the client goes, it has the ability to add and remove books or modify books. And behind the scenes, I can go do anything I want. Does that answer your question?
On the client side, if you make some software like check file,
I can talk to it. I don't have a way to show it right now. Let So let me try and show that. So let's look at this method, get latest books, right? It goes and creates a query called off of the books, off of the object context, and says, you know, return all the books ordered in this particular way, and it returns my query goal. So it hasn't actually executed the query itself yet. It's just returning a query. Now, what we will do on the client is if the client specifies, let's say, skip 5, take 5, we will send that to the server and append it or compose it into this query goal. So the effective query will become, you know, this query dot skip 5 dot take 5. Now, additionally, what I've also specified here in this particular example is this constraint saying the server says I can only give you back at most 5. Let's say this was actually 2 for this example's sake. What we will actually do is then tack on that constraint as well and say dot take 2. So your final query is actually all of this dot skip 5 dot take 5 dot take 2. That's the query that we'll send to the database. So if you were to go attach, like, let's say a profiler, a SQL profiler on your database and look at the queries that are coming in, you will actually see top 2 effectively in your actual SQL statement that goes to the database. So if you really want to see what query is going in, a SQL profiler type of tool will see that show you the exact queries that are going to your backend. I know I saw one other hand go up there earlier and while taking that question. There's still a question back there. Okay. So the question is, if I was doing a normal ASP.NET website, and so the biggest value for real services comes when you have potentially multiple clients that want to consume the same business logic. So let me give you an example. So I'm writing a Silverlight application, let's say this book club application, but I also want to create a alternate content, like a sitemap, for example, so that search engine can find all the relevant URIs and the relevant content for those URIs. So I could use the same query methods, for example, get latest books or get books from an ASP.NET MVC controller that consumes this class to produce those different views. So that's where you know, it really helps to have this business logic kind of encapsulated in a layer by itself. Now, if I was doing just ASP.NET and nothing else, then you could argue that maybe I can put this logic in the controller itself. But I think that there's actually fewer applications that are only going to be server-side. There's increasingly going to be either Silverlight applications or Ajax, HTML type of applications that want to go and get data from a service directly, right? And so this kind of pattern sets you up to be able to take that next step even if you don't need it today, is the way I kind of think about it. So let me actually take that question, and then maybe Jeff can share something on the phone. And is that something that's of interest to folks?
I can agree with that.
Okay. You can set it up over here while I take that question. Say that again. I'm not sure I follow.
A loading screen, you're getting a large amount of data.
Uh-huh.
And a loading screen is controlling the resource.
You mean how do I access streaming data?
I think it means a progress bar.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, a progress bar. So when you call, when you make a load method, it will actually, there will be a, there's a Boolean that says it's loading, and you can tie that is loading to your progress bar. I'm not sure. In general, you are making, you know when you're making the calls to load and when the completion callback comes back, right? So in general, you would tie the progress bar to your application logic rather than to this sort of infrastructure code. Oh, yeah, there's really no good way to show percentage complete. You can show that there's activity going on. In general, you don't ever know how much has been completed, right, until the response comes back. Take this laptop off. Do you want this? Never mind that then.
So really quick, this is a Windows phone. It works, it's real. They're coming out. If anyone wants to play with this, or if you have apps, I can run your apps real quick. If you've been to the doctor recently, the eye doctor, the front row can probably see the screen. Everyone else cannot, I suppose. One of the big things in the Windows phone is that the UI paradigm is a little different. So there's a tab control.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us over here.